This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 23rd of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 320 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. With me, Robert Bounds and Tom Edwards.
A weird and wonderful cultural adventure ahead today, as first up we'll be finding out about the timeless connection between literature and the animal world, as the prestigious British Library gathers some extraordinary material featuring creatures, great and small. Literary zookeeper come curator Matthew Shaw will be guiding us through.
We'll then invite author Roger Luckhurst to examine the ghoulish, morbid world of the zombie. Why has popular culture for so long dwelled on the macabre and terrifying image of the undead? From trashy B-movie to folklore and computer games, we'll be stepping into the dark side.
And then, as the North American box office reels at the spectacular success of rap biopic Straight Outta Compton, we speak to New York Magazine's Film Man on the rise and rise of the true story in film and why this particular movie has struck such a chord with US audiences.
That's all coming up, plus Danny Jacopelli will be here with the week's coming news, and we'll play some great music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So, Tom, welcome to the programme. I'm looking forward to today. It sounds like a classic in the making, right?
I've got to say, I'm slightly wary because of the zombie element.
Okay. Do you scare easily? Have you had an experience?
I'm a bit jittery.
Are you?
And what I like about zombies is they're easy to outrun, of course, famously.
Yeah, they're
not the most dynamic.
That's okay.
But
they never stop. You're running away from the zombie. It's the relentlessness.
That's it.
It's the unrelenting nature.
We're in the confines here of the studio. It's dark. It's quiet.
It's cold.
It feels like an environment for the undead, frankly.
Okay. I don't know how we can possibly iron this out other than with a guest who's going to be talking about animal magic. You are the same age as me. You familiar with Johnny Morris on the BBC?
Can you do any of those little bird noises and all that kind of thing? I tell you what,
I've got an idea for a song. Why don't we go to Danny Jacopelli and we'll have the news look ahead, and then maybe we can put that song on to preface.
Perfect.
Preface the animal.
Let's lure Danny Jacopelli.
I think we're always trying to theme a song to the guests or to some of the topics of discussion. We've got an embarrassment of riches today.
I wonder what
studio manager Claire Urban
has
going to take
sleeve.
Up her, yeah, exactly. It's going to take. Will it be an animal sleeve? Will it be a zombie sleeve? Or will it be the other one? What? That was not rude.
Sorry.
But I know a man who is.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day.
The winner of the underage schoolgirl lookalike competition is with us. It's Danny Jacopelli and his news look ahead.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Danny.
Always a pleasure, might I add.
I've got to think of something new to say each week.
You love spending your Sundays with us, don't you?
Come on.
Don't tell any fibs.
Yep, I do.
God, that was really pained. What's happening next week, Danny?
What's in the news hopper next week?
You know, normally start serious and light. Yeah. I'd like to start off today's news look ahead by talking about a tremendous story that's taking place on the 23rd. Tropical Storm Danny is on track to become the first Atlantic hurricane of 2015. I think this is the first time I've ever been a tropical storm.
What kind of tropical storm is this? Is this a typhoon? Is it a cyclone? Is it a good old hurricane? Will it be carrying a comb like the Fonz in its back pocket?
I don't know. It's approaching the Caribbean. Do you say Caribbean or Caribbean?
Caribbean.
I say Caribbean.
Because that's correct. But, you know, let's not get bogged down on detail.
Is it correct, though?
I think you're fine.
Okay, anyway. So it's going there?
Yep. So I just, well, I mean, it has the same name as me, so I had to throw that in there.
What sort of strength of hurricane is it? I mean, you know.
You're asking far too many technical questions, Rob.
Okay.
I just like the name.
Okay. I'm trying to transpose some meaning of you onto it, whether it's
that's probably very competent, professional.
Is it a strong, silent type, or is it?
Good journalistic instinct, probably.
Okay.
I don't know.
Hurricane
strong
temperance, then.
Upper body strength, maybe.
Strong upper body strength.
Pretty
this
sure
is
that's,
top
not,
Trump.
That's not meteorological.
0 to 60 in 6.2 seconds.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye on the take. We'll keep an eye on Storm Danny.
Indeed.
And and depending upon how many people's lives it ruins, we'll decide whether or not that's funny this time next week.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Whether or not how completely incorrect we were.
In the meantime, though, we can make jokes about things like when Danny will make landfall. Can we say things like that?
I love that phrase.
The destructive power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Shall we move on?
Yes.
The 26th. This is a great festival. The La Tomatina Tomato Throwing Festival.
Ah, yeah.
In Spain. My former flatmate, this crazy Scottish guy who now lives in Dubai, maybe he's listening, he's kind of nuts. He once bought an old Volvo car for like 500 quid, drove with his friends to Spain to go to this event, ended up slipping on tomatoes on the cobblestone floors and completely knocking out his two front teeth.
Whoa.
Both of his front teeth went missing from this event. So there
if he'd
we
been
are.
Driving a very solid Volvo at the time, that
yes.
would have never happened.
Yes, fine. Exactly. So,
that's horrible.
But yeah,
that's a reason, that's a reason not to go because of dental.
There's 100,000 kilograms of overripe tomatoes that will be there.
And they just throw them at each other.
The entire event lasts 15 minutes.
God, that is fast and
12,000 people take part. Is it a waste of food?
Well, no. Well,
they're overripe.
Yes,
are they going to?
Doesn't that mean each person is throwing 10 tons of? I've done a quick back of the envelope.
100,000 kg divided by 12,000.
Oh, 10 kilos. Oh, no, 10 kilos. That's a reasonable.
That's a reasonable
for 15 minutes. I'd say
it's still quite a lot of tomatoes, but
it's a great deal.
The 26th.
Are your friend's
also,
teeth still there somewhere?
He has fake teeth now. There. I shouldn't be talking about him now.
£500.
The world now knows.
£500 quite a lot of money for a Scotsman to spend on anything. Let's move on.
You just angered the entire northern half.
It's another nation on Rob's
the entire northern half of England.
Growing list of Rob's.
And the rest. Well done, honey.
The 26th, then this is an event that happens every year. The Air Guitar World Championship in Finland.
Yes.
I think I've said this probably the last 4 years, but once again, it's taking place. It's in Lapland, I've been told, so it's quite up there. Mm. Each guitarist takes the stage for 3 minutes. They have 1 minute to play a song chosen by a judge, one during which the air guitar can be presented by his own skills.
Yeah.
So hang on, the judge chooses the music and they have to respond to it?
They're not three disciplines. It's like,
freestyle,
you get your own track and then you have a lucky
dip. The judge chooses the song.
Okay. What would you play?
Then the person has 1 minute to present their own song.
Oh, I see.
I don't know what the other minute
is. What would your song be? Would it be your Danny Jingle? Quite hard to air guitar.
I like this. The only real rule is that the contestants may not perform on an actual guitar.
Okay.
There'll be a big
asterisk there.
Funny if someone brings an
I think
actual.
That's kind of intuitive, isn't it? Yeah, in an air guitar
so.
Event.
But do you think at that event there are those awful words that always happen at any live concert?
Freebird?
And now for some new material. what would you play, Danny?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, da-na-na-na-na-na. Oh, that's Layla.
That's Layla.
Derek and the Dominos.
Derek and Dominos, yeah.
I knew that.
You'd have that.
Eric
cool.
Clapton's first, second, third band, I don't know.
Yeah.
What about you, Rob? What would you go for?
It's rich. Yeah, I don't know.
I'd probably get the lead out.
You get the lead out, would you? Yeah. You go Lemon Song.
Maybe something like that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Something from your childhood, maybe, Elvis?
I'd like to do Air Harmonica.
That would be good.
I'd maybe do Can't You Hear Me Knocking by the Stones.
I'd like to make a very seamless transition from this to a very serious topic. So
okay.
Maybe we should take 5 seconds of silence to...
No, because then that's going to make it worse.
To cleanse the palate like a nice gelato.
Okay.
The 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina is coming up. Was that enough time between the two?
This is a perfect coda from the first light story and the tragic end story.
They're
about the same thing.
Can you believe it's been 10 years? So the 29th marks the 10-year anniversary. Obama is going to go down to New Orleans ahead of their anniversary to meet with people. But 10 years. It seems like it was yesterday.
It does, doesn't it?
No, really. It does seem like it was a lot less than 10 years, but there we are.
Interestingly, one imagines that kind of socially, culturally... A lot of the kind of wounds are probably still very fresh for a lot of people.
Oh, on your side of the pond. Well, yeah, and they're...
Forget how divisive...
Still rebuilding a lot of
quite
areas.
Quite rightly that was at the time.
Yep. Okay, I had to put that in there because actually it's quite important.
This is going to be a
terrible transition right now.
Don't show you're working. This is a math exam.
But it wouldn't be the first time. The mashed potato wrestling festival.
Oh, for God's sake, Danny.
In South Dakota.
You can't go back to that.
I just did.
Oh, my God. Okay. Mashed potato.
That should have gone with the tomato throwing.
Oh, I should have organized this
should
a little bit better.
You should have made yourself a...
I should have put the storms together and the food throwing.
Two storms, light storm and serious
food
storm.
Food fights and storms.
Food fights together.
Clearly delineated.
So the matches ordinarily take place in pools filled with mashed spuds. Less active fans, I've been told, have the option of potato sculpting.
Are you on drugs?
All right, one final one. You know, last week you guys met the wonderful... are we ending it now?
No, come on. Where are you going to finish?
We're just going to stop. Next
Sunday, Notting Hill Carnival.
Okay, great. Well, that's good.
And you guys know all about that because last week...
We had Norman Jay on the show, which I sadly missed because I was ill on the day.
Even though Norman, of course, he's not going anymore.
Oh, okay.
He's very much fallen out of love. People should listen. Regular listeners will have heard last week, but if you didn't, you should tune into last week's episode.
That was great.
Hear why. Really interesting.
I think many people think it might have turned into the Notting Hill Carnival, sponsored by a sort of major American wine producer.
Exactly. That's what's turned people's stomachs.
But who knows? I've had many an amusing time at the Notting Hill Carnival.
I went last year. You know, it's one of those things where there's so many people that you can't even move, which could be fun and could be not fun. Generally, it's not fun.
One of my ex-girlfriends lived in a mews at the top of Ledbury Road in Notting Hill.
Bad news.
Bad news on Notting Hill Carnival Day.
People urinate all over the walls.
Like there is a wrought iron gate to enter the mews, which you obviously lock. But then you walk out in the morning to literally what can only be described as a feast of willies urinating directly into your...
Who would describe it like that?
I don't know.
Often you see the houses on that row, they board them up with plywood. Yeah. So nobody can throw stuff through the windows just because there's masses of people, humanity.
Not a feast of willies then, maybe like a snake pit.
Are you the charmer?
No, I'm not. I'm not putting my flute anywhere near it. All right, that was the news. Okay, with Danny Jacopelli. Thank you very much. The connection that we have to the animal world is deep, whether it's a profound respect, a dependence, or a search for companionship. And in fact, the depiction in pictures or text of animals is as old as literature itself. From cave paintings to Victorian prints, the otherworldliness of the creatures we share this planet with has always made them the subject of our fascination.
Well, a new exhibition at that Temple of the Written Word, the British Library, charts this bountiful culture of beasts large and small. Animal Tales makes use of the library's vast archives to offer a selection of material from its collections that takes the visitor on a literary and illustrative safari, oh yes, through our fear, fondness and bewilderment of animals.
Head zookeeper, or rather lead curator of the exhibition and curator of the British Library's Americas and Australasia collection is Matthew Shaw, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, good to see you.
Now, this is a kind of show where you have to, I mean, obviously, when you're curating any show, you have to leave things out as much as keep things in. How many darlings, how many small little furry darlings did you have to kill to put this show together, Matthew?
Yeah, there are a few things that fell were crushed underfoot on the way. We cut out things like anthropomorphic animals. So
okay.
Paddington, sadly, isn't in there.
Oh, we were just talking about Paddington before we switched on the microphone.
Yeah, I know. No marmalade sandwiches or anything like that. No, so we're really focused on animals, which had a really close connection with literary authors, really, as well as children's authors. So animals as animals.
So we're kind of talking about what we might call the more literary end rather than the children's books end. Is that what we're saying?
Exactly, yeah. Though the children's side of it is a really interesting story and was kind of our way in to some extent. We wondered why animals are so prevalent in children's literature and the history of that. So we have a section looking at that question.
Yeah. Matthew, I wanted to ask, I mean, I guess it's a big question, and sort of Rob in the introduction alluded to this extraordinary, you know, relationship, I guess, between man and beast through history, and it's documented in literature, of course. It's a bigger question, but do you try and answer it? Why? You know, why does this endure? What is this fascination? There's a pragmatism to it, of course, with the interdependence we talked about. But is it something more fundamental even than that?
Yeah, well, there we have a section that looks at this question of why we've had this intimate relationship with animals. And we have some manuscripts by the critic John Berger, who in his piece, Why Look at Animals, said we've always lived close to animals. They've been sacred beings since the days of cave paintings and so on. But since then, since industrialization, since animals are now in the fields, and we don't even see fields that often, they've been removed from us. So they don't occupy that same psychological space, but they still have an echo in our lives. And they've somehow taken over literature as a consequence of that.
And I suppose you say that you don't want to focus on the anthropomorphization of animals, but there is an idea of tameness and wildness, I suppose, to these animals that you look at, and whether or not they are part of an extension of the human world, or whether the human world butts up against the animal world, and they're very different things, I presume.
Yeah, I guess there are couple of questions there. One is the thing which people have always asked about, what makes a human human and an animal an animal? And we have a very early edition of Montaigne's
essay. About 10 pints.
Yeah, about 10 and then we're growling and howling. Yeah, Montaigne was down in his in France in his library in sort of the 17th century, and he wasn't alone in his library, though he normally was depicted as such. But he was there with his cat, and he was playing with his cat. And then he actually reflected, "Oh, wait a minute, am I playing with my cat, or is my cat playing with me?" So he, as a philosopher, used that example of the animal to think about what it means to be conscious, what it means to be human, what it means to be an animal. We have a nice little edition of that, which has been illustrated by the Dutch owner in the 17th century. So that's one thing about animals. Mm. The other thing is this wild and tamed thing. So we have at the end a section which is called The Call of the Wild. So it's this relationship we have with animals as animals, and we're drawn to that wildness that they have. And we sometimes try and tame them as pets, and they somehow become different. They're domesticated, yet within them lurks that wildness. And I think perhaps some authors, and we have William Burroughs in there, the Beat writer, and obviously quite a wild character. He had his cats, he loved his cats, but he recognised the wild side that they had as well.
Matthew, let me ask about some of the strands maybe that run through. It's interesting to look at the writers who write well on animals or about their own animals or experiences with the animal world. Do you find, it's interesting what you say about Burroughs being a wild character, are there strands that run through it? You know, is there a particular type of writer who understands the animal kingdom? Were there sort of strands that you could identify that ran through even the different sections of the exhibition?
That's an interesting question. I think there are a couple of sort of things we wondered about. The fact that writers spend a lot of time sort of in front of the typewriter or with their pen somewhere and maybe alone and have a slightly dark view of human life and society, maybe. So animals are an attraction to them there. So that's one thing that they're drawn to. Others, I think, have been through their own personal trauma or difficulty, and animals are an escape for that. So we have Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, which is sort of the most recent example of that sort of literature, but also Tarka the Otter, and Williamson sort of withdrew from society and into this little shed in his garden out in the countryside and observed the local otters there. So there's those two strands, I suppose.
It's an interesting thing, H is for Hawk, which is a wonderful book, and that is a book that's written about her taming and living with this hawk, but also it's about a book that she's reading while she's writing her own book, which is E.H. White's book on falconry. And that's an interesting thing. That I wonder whether it is that historical perspective of her writing her book 100 years after White wrote his that tells us something about our relationship with animals, and that she's kind of reaching out to what she thinks is something that is endangered and a way of life that is in danger. And even the way of life of the creatures that the hawk would eat naturally is in danger. Is that something? Is there an idea, without being heavy-handed with it, is there an idea of clinging on to some idea of preservation? Has that always been a part of humans' relationship with animals, especially in literature?
Yeah, I don't know if it's always been a part of it. I mean, we have some books owned by the Romantic poets, by Coleridge and Wordsworth, who they've annotated them, and they've got really sort of interested in the natural world, which is really meaning for them. But it's not a world that's being lost for them. It's only, you know, the last 50 years that world has begun to vanish. And again, the last section explores this idea of the world which is disappearing, in the real sense that things are going. And the very first piece we have is Gilbert White, the naturalist, who wrote A Natural History of Selborne, a letter he wrote to a friend talking about all the birds he'd seen, and he's saying, I'm doing a piece of natural history and here are all the birds that are in my garden, in my country garden. And people have written in saying this is quite poignant because a lot of these, they're either endangered or they're no longer with us. So that's a thread that runs all the way through the show, I suppose, things that are lost or endangered, and sort of the sad state that animals are often in. I mean, we'd like to see them in zoos, and they are well cared for now, but there's also something quite sad and poignant about these creatures which were once wild and roaming free and exemplified all that was majestic and noble, and suddenly they're just there as a piece of entertainment.
Matthew, you talked about children's books, and it's not necessarily, you know, some of them feature, but it's not necessarily about that. What about in your own experience? Was the animal in literature, I don't know, part of the thing that made you get interested in this area, you know, your love of books? Was it inspired by that? Were there any particular examples? I don't know if they're in the exhibition even, but were there things, I don't know, even from when you were reading as a kid, where they were particularly poignant or striking or things that just connected with you for some reason?
Yeah, I mean, definitely have been books, Tarka the Otter being one. But the thing that really got me interested in this question, I suppose, is I have an 18-month-old son, and he's very keen on animals and animal noises and so on. And so we have two things related to that. We have something from the 17th century, the first children's book, really, Comenius's natural history, and it's an A to Z, but instead of being A's for apple and things like that, it has the duck quacketh. So you learn by, by sounds, the bear growleth and things like that. So it shows that that thread has always been there, and I'm quite pleased that that's in there. But he's very keen on the tiger who came for tea. And actually
classic.
Classic.
Absolute classic.
Lent his tiny copy of it because it fitted nicely in a corner and the lion just peeks out. So Ra-Ra, as he calls him, is there in the show. So those items are in there. But Peter Rabbit, of course, had to be in there. So he's there as an example of someone who's really a naturalist. Beatrix Potter spent a lot of time observing, drawing from nature. So her animals aren't as slushy and sentimental as a lot of the other Edwardian children's literature that's produced at the time. And her view of the natural world is, you know, it's quite dark. Peter Rabbit is at risk from getting shot and so on. Mm. So it's not as sentimental as other books of the time.
And what about Moby Dick? Does he have a starring role? I mean, just for the idea of thinking purely metaphorically about animals, whether they're Animal Farm in Orwell or whether they're Moby Dick, you know, Melville, whether they are, whether you know, animals completely used as a construct, to, as the structure of the inside of a man's head.
Yeah, no, Moby Dick, we always knew he was going to sort of lurk there somewhere. Yeah. So he's at the end of this Call of the Wild.
Depths.
In the depths, exactly, in the dark, at the lowest bit of the case. And we have the Lakeside Press edition, which is the classic, large, fine press edition, which Rockwell Kent did those wonderful, they look like woodcuts, but they're sort of very inky black depictions of the whale sort of consuming boats and so on. And he's there, and we have a title, though, Sometimes a Whale is Just a Whale, which comes from Law and Order, believe it or not, that's the one that we snuck in.
Okay.
And it's that mixture of the whale. He really, Melville, knew about whaling. His observations of whales and they were really accurate. It's a real whale in there, but it's also, of course, full of symbolism, full of those suggested ideas about darkness and the depths and wildness. So it's there. Those two things are there within this book. So he's lurking at the end of the show in a soundscape, which is drawn from the library sound collections of natural history. So there are birds. It starts with birds and makes its way down. In the end, you hear whales sort of swimming around the library in the last little bit of the show.
Matthew, it's interesting to look at, you've already alluded to this earlier, about how people may be losing the immediacy of nature. You know, we don't engage with animals in the way we did when everyone was living more of a sort of rural lifestyle. Have you detected, I don't know, when sort of researching this show, a change in the way people write, or maybe the facility with which people write about animals in particular? Are people getting less good at it, maybe, because they lack that immediacy, that experience? Or do you think they're still, we talked about H's for Hawk, you know, they're still great writing that is about animals? Yeah. Do people's skill as a writer overcome that problem, perhaps?
If anything, we suggest it's really got better as people have become or made the use of natural history writing and observation of natural history and the animals. There may be fewer of them around, but where they
were
around,
see more of them, I suppose, because of the media and the sort
exactly.
Of thing.
We wanted to, we almost had a section on the influence of TV and so on. But we suggest that zoos put animals in front of people for the first time, and that's part of the reason why children's books have lions and tigers and people can see them. And people like David Garnett, a Bloomsbury writer, could play with that idea and wonder what it'd be like to put a man inside a zoo. Mm. And then from the 60s onwards again, and people like Ted Hughes made nature writing something substantial and meaningful. So people have returned to it really from the, you know, from the 60s through the 80s. And then we're really seeing a rebirth, resurgence of that. And people write about nature really beautifully, really well, I think, at the moment. And that twin aspect of it's they know it's about us. They know it's about themselves as the writer. But they're also adept at realizing animals inhabit their own world, their own behaviors, they have their own sort of language, and we can't get at it. We can just observe it. We can just get snatches of it. And I think that's awareness of nature writing has really come back in.
Well, it's beautiful stuff. It's beguiling just talking about it. I can't wait to come and see the show. It's on all summer, I guess, at the British Library. Its curator is Matthew Shaw. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, in a tribute to the animal world, why don't we cut to the one and only Louis Prima? This is from The Jungle Book. Tom, is this one of your favourite songs?
100%, Rob.
Here we go, I Want to Be Like You.
Yeah, I can learn to be like someone like me.
That was Louis Prima performing I Want to Be Like You from The Jungle Book, of course. Why on earth were we talking about that? Because we had Matthew Shaw talking about animal tales. But it's zombies next.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
This is the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Now, it may not be Halloween yet, but we're going to venture to the dark side with our next guest, whether it's in the sublimely ridiculous special effects of American B-movies, or the morbid folkloric underworld of West Indian slaves in the 19th century, or even the prototype baddie in computer games. The notions of the half-dead, the animated corpse, the zombie coming to get you is an undeniable part of our popular culture.
So much so that one academic's decided to study this in depth. Zombies, A Cultural History is a new book by Roger Luckhurst, which tries to make sense of this macabre fascination for the undead. Could the creepy emergence and re-emergence and re-re-re-emergence of the zombie be a metaphor for a society sick with itself? Do we, like the protagonists of those B-movies, see ourselves as a cut above the rest? Are we all scared or resentful of the grim encroaching masses? Or do we all just love a bit of cadaverish ghoul from time to time? To answer those questions, Roger Luckhurst is here, and he joins us fully undead here in the studio.
Yes, I think technically I am undead, yes.
I like the way you had to check. You took a real sharp intake of breath there before deciding whether or not our guest is...
That's radio drama for you.
That is very good.
Now, Roger, I was going to start by asking you about, you know, you've got a cultural history that you've written. Is it one of these things where there is a truth about zombies? Is there some fundamental thing that perhaps people haven't been willing to confront maybe thus far?
Oh yeah, I think there is. I mean, there are lots of people who, anthropologists, for example, who would say that zombies do actually exist. Now, what they mean by that is that there are certain cultures that define people, perhaps outsiders, as being in a state of not quite them, not quite alive, and it becomes a kind of almost literal metaphor. They are technically not of our kind, so therefore these people are expelled from the culture. And if you're defined by your relationships and they suddenly are severed from you, people actually are in a state of kind of social death, it can be called.
As Tom said in the preface to introducing you, you talked about kind of the slave culture of the 19th century, and there are lots of cultures that have this similar sort of purgatorial state, we might say. Was your kickoff for this loving the films of George A. Romero and Shaun of the Dead and these kind of updates of it, or was it actually what you might call the more scholarly stuff or the historical stuff, and which stuff surprised you?
The most amazing thing, I think, was that everyone, I think, starts with Romero. Yeah. So Night of the Living Dead in 1968, and that's where most people start. And I thought, well, you know, this is an obvious place to start. Actually, I don't get there until the very end of the book, because there's so much that happens before that. And one of the most just brilliant people I encountered was a journalist called William Seabrook, who, among other things, was paid to be a cannibal in the 1930s by one of his editors, who just said, go to West Africa and join a cannibal cult. In the end, he had to buy a corpse from the Paris morgue and cook that up for his friends and reported on what human flesh tasted like. So he was a rather brilliant figure. And he is the man who went to Haiti in 1929 and was shown dead men working in cane fields. It's this very famous moment where he is literally shown actual figures in this cane field working, and wrote a short piece that then became the first ever Hollywood zombie film, White Zombie. So that's the kind of really interesting moment right at the beginning of this history. And then I tried to track it back a little bit further, and there is another really interesting journalist in the 1880s who has this hilarious attempt to try and define with this West Indian slave, what does zombie mean? And she keeps changing the definition of it, and he gets increasingly frustrated, and it draws you in as a reader, because what does it mean, actually? It seems to mean lots of different things. And it's only when you get to Romero that you get this fix that we think we know what a zombie is.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because you chart the routes very carefully, and there is a lot of it is this sort of transatlantic manoeuvrings, and we go back, as Rob says, to the sort of 19th century. Is there then a truly international notion of zombiehood now? And is it, as you just basically alluded to, is Romero the man to blame? Or does it still have different sort of international dimensions? Depending where you go,
it can still mean something rather different.
It really does depend on where you are. And in fact, the word zombie comes, well, they think from West Africa, but it's in its translation to the slave plantations in the West Indies. And then in its translation again, it acquires an E on the end when it gets to America in the 1920s. And then it shifts again. So I think now you can get lots and lots of different kinds of terms, particularly in Africa at the moment. It always happens at points of real stress about migration, particularly of others coming in. So particularly on the borders of South Africa going north, there's a lot of fears of witchcraft, a lot of stories about people who are slaves at night who work on magic mountains and so on. So it does change according to which culture you're in.
I wanted to talk about Night of the Living Dead and how, I mean, this was a kind of film about consumerism, wasn't it? Largely, I mean, this is how it's kind of understood. This was, what, mid-70s film, is this?
Well, George Romero's first film, Night of the Living Dead, is 1968, that's famously. So it's that kind of revolutionary moment. But he never uses the word zombie in that film.
Ah, he never uses it.
So it's really the second one in the series, which
I'm thinking Dawn of the Dead. Is what I'm thinking,
1978.
Yeah.
Which is when you get all the shopping mall staff. So that's when, so you have all of these zombies wandering around. What actually is the first ever indoor shopping mall ever built? And it happened that Romero's friend had just built it. So before anyone moved in, they could make this zombie film about it.
Fantastic. Well, fantastic branding opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it became, of course, the thing to do to go and watch it in shopping malls. So that sort of sense of you being involved in it and being a consumer of the very thing that's criticising you for being a brainless idiot, you know, is part of the fun.
And I wanted to ask you about that, the fact that, you know, how readily zombiedom can be used to transpose meaning about other things, you know, whether you can use it, you can use it to discuss borders. I mean, you know, we could talk about it right now. It's always, other than it's sort of actual sort of historical root, it's something that's kind of quite a cultural movable feast, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Is that the attraction as a scholar for
you? Yeah, I mean, I think so. It's a sense in which quite a lot of figures of these sort of halfway in between life and death, like vampires and so on, become very open to different kinds of meanings depending on where you are. So obviously, you know, the vampire is something that can be about money, or it can be about sex, or it can be about immigration. And that's the same with the zombie as well. There is this really dominant version, though, that it's all about consumerism. And that's partly because Romero was a satirist. You know, that Dawn of the Dead is a satire on consumerism. And people have taken that as a, oh, well, great, this is an incredibly liberal, progressive kind of metaphor that we can use. But it still has these roots in really, really vicious, nasty kind of slave plantation stuff that I think is still there. I mean, people love The Walking Dead. I love The Walking Dead. But there's a reason why it's set where it is down in the South. And they are actually wandering around old slave plantations for most of that series. And there is a lot of kind of Twitter buzz always about the fact that it's always the black characters that get killed off in that. So in a sense, that history is still there. The undertow of that racial element is always there, I think.
I wanted to ask you about the modern day then, or the Western world, if you like. Let's talk about, you know, the Deep South. Because, you know, you think about the cultural nuances in somewhere like New Orleans, where, you know, there are still people talk about voodoo, which I know is a little bit different. Is that still there now, or is it more in the sort of developing world where you get those sorts of moral panics? You still have the ignorance that you've described a little bit about different people from outside coming in, or do we see this in I don't know what to call it, the Western world, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do. I think basically wherever there is at the moment economic distress. So some people have said that since 2008 crash, the zombie has become really dominant metaphor, because actually it's about this sense of us being in crisis. I was just reading a management human resources book the other day called Dead Men Working. So this sort of sense of
we people, say we're sleepwalking our way to financial collapse.
Yeah.
Don't we? You
know? We work too many hours. We feel dead when we get home. We use these metaphors of zombiedom all the time. I'm just going to zombie out in front of the TV. So that sort of sense in which it is about us, as well as, I mean, the easy thing to do is always say, well, it's a superstition over there, so it's what, you know, developing countries believe in, or it's what you know, still in Haiti, because it's an undeveloped country, they believe in. But actually we're the ones who have picked up with that metaphor and really, really gone with it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Has it been used to discuss current political, sociological details in Haiti, for example, in the South, in the United States? Or is it still folklore, mythology, quasi-religious stuff? And it's only us that like to transpose its meaning? Or is it the same for them?
I think voodoo is such a complicated religion, and and metaphor is at its heart. So in a way, it's very, very flexible and very wonderfully nuanced. And actually, anyone who goes in there as an observer can never quite get what's going on.
Not alive.
Not alive. Exactly. Yeah. Particularly if you're a chicken, never get out alive.
Take that costume off, Roger.
So there is a kind of sense of, even in those kind of religious spaces in Africa, particularly West Africa and South Africa and in the Caribbean, we think of it as literal, but actually it's incredibly metaphorical, incredibly flexible for them too.
Roger, what are some of your favourites? To bring us a bit more up to date, later in the book, Rob and I were actually talking about this before we were speaking to you, about some of the examples you'd cited from Japan. There's some of these Lolita syndrome-inspired zombie pictures. You've got Juan of the Dead, of course, works on several levels. Do you have favourites? You chart so many of them, but could you pick out a few of your picks?
I do. I have, of course, because I've written on this book, I have to have really obscure ones that no one's ever heard of. People always talk about Night of the Living Dead, and there's a reason for that. It is still amazingly overpowering. But I think just as influential, and no one ever talks about it, is this amazing film called Messiah of Evil. And that's the first film that does going into a shopping mall. It's completely empty until you get to the meat counter and the entire population of that town is eating raw meat just around the corner. And it's truly terrifying. It doesn't make any sense at all. It's completely delirious, totally strange. And you can watch it all on YouTube, actually. I really recommend that. So that's Messiah of Evil. The other one that perhaps is coming to mind because I'm in a radio studio is Pontypool. I don't know if you've seen Pontypool. Pontypool is set only in a radio studio. In Canada. And it's entirely besieged by American zombies. And the only way how zombiedom happens is from the banality of language itself. So it's these really banal DJs who are producing zombification.
I think we're in big trouble.
We are.
And they have to invent a kind of new sort of public discourse on the radio in order to stop zombification.
So they
happening.
Up the intellectual ante. Absolutely. To protect themselves.
Indeed.
From certain death.
Indeed.
Or certain undeath.
Yeah. Any shock jock cliches produce zombies, and they appear at the windows.
Should we try and beckon some from out of the ether?
This is some kind of accident waiting to happen within the rules of Midori House.
It could have happened in the early days of Monocle 24, possibly.
Yeah, I think it might have done.
Actually, it was staffed by zombies.
surely.
Me amongst them, it's fine. Let's not get too meta here. And one other thing we were saying before we came on air, we were talking about Shaun of the Dead, which is one of mine and Tom's favourite movies, and we were sort of talking about the scene where they find the first zombie in the garden, and they're going, "Oh my god, she's so drunk!" And of course, she's a zombie. I mean, zombies are sort of funny. They've been funny before Simon Pegg sort of made that movie. I mean, there is because George A. Romero's films. You said he's a great satirist, but there is genuine comedy in those films.
And actually, all of those forgotten films of the 1940s, with zombies in, were kind of comedies as well. So I mean, Bob Hope, the Ghost Hunters, and so on. That's got lots and lots of zombies in, but he's just wisecracking with them all the time. And there are famous black comedians who played zombies all the time, one of whom, you know, is carrying on talking. And someone says, "I thought zombies weren't allowed to talk." He's like, "I can't help it if I'm loquacious." And just carries on. So it has always been comical, I think, yeah.
It's fantastic stuff. The book is called Zombies, A Cultural History. The author is Roger Luckhurst. The authority is Roger Luckhurst. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with London and with New York City. New York used to be such an easy city to crack for the visitor, but now its focus has fractured and shifted. Why not let Monocle help you to navigate?
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Monocle has had a bureau in New York since its launch in 2007. And our travel guide is a celebration of all that we know and love about this place. We put together a list of the finest places and experiences the Big Apple has to offer. Be it a cozy stay at the Cosby Street Hotel, a late drink in a classic bar like King Cole in Midtown, or a top-notch fuss-free trim at Cheese in Brooklyn. Let us take you beyond the obvious to reveal the hidden spots New York has to offer. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. So pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to New York in Monocle shops at monocle.com and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. And now we head to the US and to Los Angeles via our New York Bureau.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
Just hit that first beat hard. All right, you cruising down the street.
All right. Cruising down the street in my 6'4".
Hey, that was dope, eh? When I'm called off, I got a sawed
off. Squeeze the trigger, your body's all hard off. Your songs glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
You guys supposed to be somewhere?
These are artists.
Rap is not an art.
You cannot come down here and harass my clients because of what they look like.
I promise you, things are gonna be different from here on out.
Listen, to be honest with you, I don't know anything about hip-hop, but I know that you're special.
You want to be involved with this gangster life?
Here we go.
Speak a little truth and people lose their mind.
We say New York, this has got a lot to do with Los Angeles. You just heard an excerpt from the trailer for the musical biopic Straight Outta Compton, which recounts the story of LA rap group NWA. Released 2 weeks ago in the US, the film continues to be a runaway box office success for Universal Pictures, which has just announced it will increase its theatre count for release of the film to 3,000 across the US and Canada.
As yet another biopic grips audiences, we thought we'd look at the phenomenon and so many of the people behind Straight Outta Compton were involved in the story the film is telling, including the film's director, F. Gary Gray. Where are the boundaries of this genre blurred?
Joining us on the line from our New York Bureau is New York Magazine chief film critic David Edelstein. David, welcome to the programme. And first of all, we're in funny territory with a biopic here, aren't we? Because this is a group that is all about its roots. It's all about kind of, there's a lot of social issues going on here. Do we get the dreaded moment in the film where suddenly the beat kicks in and we're listening to one of their well-known hits?
First of all, you're posing this question to a white Jewish New Yorker, which is, if the film targets anyone, it's white Jewish New Yorkers. Everything I say has to be filtered. You have to understand, everybody who's white in this movie, it's as if they're like Richard Pryor whites. The treble is turned way up and they talk like this. And they really, and if I'm going to sit and tell you about gangster rap and about the, you know, the differences between life and art here, you have to understand where it's coming from. I think the movie's dope, however. And did I say that?
I like that. We can get away with that. We're going to put a little asterisk on each kind of piece of street slang that you use, David.
Actually, 25... Only a guy like me would use dope 25 years after these guys.
I kind of like it. I'm still saying groovy. I like it.
It's a very interesting film because, first of all, everybody is frankly in it to make a lot of money, A, which they were from the beginning, and B, to create a myth of their origins. And they do a pretty darn good job. F. Gary Gray is a very talented director. He's able to use, you know, that we're all kind of bored by the handheld camera, documentary style, war type footage, but he really uses it judiciously. He immerses you in the scene. More than that, he creates this context of constant one-upmanship. These are kids who on the street get hassled by the white police, but they also get hassled by guys down the block who are in gangs. They're always having to prove themselves. And part of what this music comes out of is this fierce need to go up on stage and say, I'm rich, I'm powerful, I could kill you, I could fuck a lot of women, I could do anything I want to do, and you've got to envy me. And that comes through very vividly in the movie, whatever amount of varnish is put on the other stuff.
Well, I want to ask you about that, David, because there is this notion, going back to the roots of MWA's music, that it was always about authenticity, you know, capturing the authentic experience, whether it's out of LA or as they got more successful.
Street experience. You're going to hear the wisdom of the street.
I wonder, is there then revisionism that happens to this film? You've mentioned what the motivations are. Does that matter, or does it, as a dramatic piece, it stands by that anyway, even if there are changes? There's whole chapters that maybe aren't even told on the screen here.
Yeah, I think yes and no. A lot of the accusations, especially against Dr. Dre, of battery against women, are really downplayed in the film. He's portrayed as a very, very decent guy who walks away from, you know, when things get too terrible and too inhuman, he's the guy who pulls the plug and who walks away. And apparently that's not really true in life. If you are making a movie in which the accusations of the bad guys in the film are that you are promoting a certain view of women, a certain view of race relations, a certain view of materialism, a certain view of violence, and those people are made to look stupid, but at the same time, you, the filmmaker, are varnishing, soft-pedaling, changing some of the details, yes, that's a factor, and that's something we really ought to be aware of. Does that mean it's not a really exhilarating movie on its own terms? No, it's a gas.
To play devil's advocate on this one, David, musical biopics are kind of a tough thing to do. Do you think this movie would have packed a similar punch if it was kind of almost famous and used a kind of fictional band with which to paint the picture that they wanted to?
Oh, no, and it wouldn't have, but there would have been no need to, because these guys, look at their names. I mean, Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, they were creating characters.
Right. Yeah.
They created a fiction for themselves from the very beginning. They were playing roles, and that comes through very vividly in the film, although the interesting thing is that these men became those roles. There was no going back to what they were. What they were represented poverty and impotence and daily humiliation, and so they became these characters. But no, this is part of the myth. This is what you have to show NWA this way.
And I just wanted to know, I mean, you know, we said at the beginning of this chat, you know, as a white Jewish New Yorker speaking to us on the line from New York, what is it like watching that movie in a movie theater, even a press preview screening in New York City, David, when Ferguson has happened recently, and there are a lot of things that are teetering on the edge, perhaps not quite of the LA riots, not perhaps the level of the Rodney King, which is included in this film necessarily. So, what is the atmosphere like, even in a press screening for this movie?
Well, one aspect of this film is very contemporary. There's no way that you can see these kids come out of their recording studio in Torrance, California, and be surrounded by police who throw them onto cars and handcuff them and make them sit on the ground and not be thinking about Ferguson and not be thinking about this apparent plague of police, you know, at best harassment, at worst outright murder that's happening in this country right now and is, despite the media, virtually unchecked. So the film has an enormous immediacy. There's another sense, though, in which it doesn't feel contemporary insofar as Ice Cube might have been a very threatening character to people like me in 1988. Now I've seen him play a hassled dad. I've seen him play many cops. I've seen him fight giant anacondas. I've been on his side. And so, you know, and Dr. Dre, I have a pair of headphones by Dre at home. So these are no longer these frightening characters that they might have represent to sort of white outsiders like me back 25, 30 years ago. They've become part of the larger cultural family. So, and we know these songs. We know Fuck the Police. We know Straight Outta Compton. We know Boys in the Hood. They've become part of our collective cultural heritage. So there is something, although the movie, the music still feels very raw and very urgent, I think one of the reasons it's crossing over to a larger audience is that many of us are comfortable with this music and comfortable with these men. And also, as you said, as you suggest, we also see that certain aspects of society, at least in this country, have not changed.
David, I wonder, does the movie suggest that the journeys, the characters, the broader journey, maybe that I call them characters, that these men were going to go on? As you said, you've got Dr. Dre, who's a sort of billionaire, give or take. He's a sort of a mogul, you know, according to the sort of traditional US logic. Ice Cube, likewise, hugely rich and successful. Do you think that the movie plants that seed that they're going to go on a journey like that? Or does it just still seem improbable?
Yes and no. They are, you see them acquiring a lot of material trappings, and also there are orgy scenes in which, you know, many men are being filleted all over the place, and appetites are being indulged. You have, I mean, there's that wish fulfillment aspect. On the other hand, they always, to keep the audience's sympathy, they always have to be underdogs. And right up until the end of the film, they're underdogs. Jerry Heller, their manager, is portrayed as someone who cheated them out of a lot of money and bet on the wrong horse, this kid Eazy-E, who eventually contracts AIDS. And there's a very moving scene in a hospital where the former members of NWA, some of them, get together. But really, up until the end of the film, it's very important for us to see these guys as the underdogs. They are not, although in life, they may have victimized a lot of people through their business practices and their personal lives. That is not any component of what you see in Straight Outta Compton.
Just finally, David, you end your review in New York Magazine, and you say there's gold in that suppression, talking about, you know, what they were fighting against, but the money that they made and the way that they made their money, the group. That's kind of like a fantastic parting shot. Is that very much what the film is about as well? There is this unashamed love of bling, of wealth. This is West Coast rap, not East Coast rap. That was very much about largesse, wasn't it? The LA, the gangster
it was,
rap.
And it was about, I mean, I use the word potency very, very knowingly. I mean, this was about, you know, parading their jewels, literally and metaphorically.
And crown jewels.
and their crown jewels in front of their fans. And I want to make it clear that when I said there's gold in them, there's suppression, that was tagged to a particular scene in which there's a near riot at an arena in Detroit because they have sung this song, Fuck the Police, in defiance of the orders of the police. And so they are dragged out, and we are, those of us who are watching, see this as a very scary scene and are angry. And the members of NWA are thrown bodily into the back of this police van, and all of a sudden they burst out laughing. And if they weren't handcuffed, they would be giving each other high fives because they realize that they've just gotten the best publicity for their tour that they could possibly have, that people are going to go out and buy these albums even more as a consequence of seeing them roughed up by the police. So that's the paradox of this movie. It comes out of marginalization, it comes out of humiliation, it comes out of the worst kind of maltreatment. And yet at the same time, what do these guys say when they go off to distribute their first record? Let's go make some money. And the movie is honest enough about that. The movie is honest enough to say that is central to this idea of who these guys are and what this music is about.
Well, it's a story beautifully told and reviewed by David Edelstein. We read him there, here, we read him there. And it's great to have him on the Monocle Weekly. David Edelstein from New York Magazine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
There we have it, Tom. That was edition 320 of the Monocle Weekly. I love that show.
What a great show.
I put that up among the upper echelons, the classics of the Monocle Weekly.
Definitely. If we're talking echelons, that's upper.
I'm very glad I came in here on a Sunday. I met great people. It was lovely hanging out with you.
Indeed.
The studio's far too cold, but hey, we're going to go out into the warm and gay summer London sunshine.
Exactly.
And frolic.
I'm up for
roast
some frolicking.
Dinners and all the rest of it.
That's the way to spend a Sunday afternoon in my book.
Yeah, to gamble.
Yes.
What do you think about that? Maybe
I'm ready
somewhere,
for some
somewhere around the Highbury Fields area. What do you
Perfect.
Think about that?
Yeah? Right, it writes itself.
A few jars, classic. All it remains for us to do is to thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.